This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
What do you suppose we have learned about the American economy this week and over the past 20 years? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 10th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's been kind of a hodgepodge week, to be honest, for those of us whose specialty is this economy. Here to help sort it out are Kate Davidson. She's at the Wall Street Journal. Also, Brian Chung. He's at Yahoo Finance. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Kate, I'm going to start with you and with this observation of the news of the day. The producer price index came out this morning. That is, of course, prices at the wholesale level up 8.3% in a year. Do you suppose anybody at the Fed, or more accurately, at the White House, walked over to Jay Powell's office and said, "Hey, Jay, how you liking transitory now, pal?"
Well, I don't know about the White House, because they're sticking to the transitory story. They put out some new forecasts. Yeah. I think it was late last month, essentially showing that they still think prices are coming down this year by a lot. So they more than doubled their forecast for inflation this year. You know, back in February, they thought it would be just a little above 2%. Now they're at 4.8 for the year. That's fourth quarter over compared to the fourth quarter of last year. But you know, even to get to that point, as you pointed out, prices are so high. And consumer prices last month, or in July rather, consumer prices were 5.4% over the previous 12 months. And that's the highest they'd been on an annual basis since 2008. So they're high. And to get to the White House's forecast, they'd have to come down a lot. So I think that they are feeling the political heat over rising prices, right? Republicans are really hammering them on this. But I think that the economists there, and even at the Fed, I mean, we'll find out in a couple of weeks, the Fed might mark up their forecast. But so far, they continue to think that these price pressures will fade.
Brian, with the observation that the consumer price index, prices obviously at the consumer level, inflation at the consumer level, comes out next week. I'm obliged to point out here that Geeta Gopinath, she's the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, said this week in a tweet, "You know what? Transitory is going to be measured in the United States and also in Europe, not in months, but in quarters. That is to say, it's going to be a while."
Yeah, and that underscores the broader point here, which is that even though a lot of Fed officials and just economists at large have said inflation may be transitory, which is their fancy word for temporary, it may be transitorily high for longer than people expected. There was a discussion that maybe after these base effects, which is kind of when you compare the deepest months of 2020, where we saw price drops against the high price increases of 2021, that you once you start to get to the later months of September, October, November, that maybe that's when you start to see inflation numbers come back to those pre-pandemic levels. It seems like that's not going to be the case. And that's likely because of the Delta-induced supply chain issues that have continued. We spoke with a CEO of Traeger Grills. They make grills, and they said that they're paying up to 10 times the amount of money for an inbound freight from Asia. And they said that's not likely to continue. That has nothing to do with Fed policy. That's just ports being closed around the world. And that's something they hope will fade in the coming months.
Yeah, our reporting shows the same thing about those containers. Hey, Kate, listen, I do not want to get into Federal Reserve Kremlinology, but do you think, and this will be the only time we'll mention this on this program, do you think Jay Powell's job is actually at risk?
Oh, that's a tough question.
That is not what I expected.
Oh, boy. Uh-oh, did I answer that incorrectly?
No, sorry.
Well, I don't think his job, I'm not sure if his job is at risk. I mean, I really don't. Like, there's a lot of pressure from progressives. And look, if it's at risk, it's not over this issue, I don't think. I mean, I think that on monetary policy, generally, I think most people in the administration think he's done a good job in steering the economy. But I think there is a lot of pressure on the regulatory side, I guess, folks who are concerned about climate change and whether the Fed has been tough enough on those issues. Do they have enough influence, you know, over the White House to push this one way or the other? Can they convince the president, look, you want to put in your own person who's really strong on these issues, these other issues? I'm not sure. You know, if I had to, you know, put money on it today, I would say I think Jay Powell is staying in his job. Yeah. But I think I think that. It's a little bit unclear. Maybe still we have a few more weeks to find out what's going to happen.
Speaking of a few more weeks, Brian Chung, I'm obliged to point out here that Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, sent a letter to Congress this week saying, in essence, come on with the debt limit. Are we really going to not pay our debts? What?
Well, so I guess we need to back up to August of 2019. That was when the Bipartisan Budget Act suspended the limit through the end of July this year. That meant that August 1st this year, the debt limit was reset to the old ceiling of $22 trillion. That was blown through. So that means that the Treasury has to go through that reserve. And the projections are that they'll run out of cash sometime either in October or November. And Yellen has said many times, not just this week, that this would cause irreparable harm if the Treasury were not able to pay its bills on the government debt that's issued around the world. Now, of course, the probability of this actually happening, that the U.S. would default on their debt and that the credit ratings would go down, is extremely unlikely. But of course, you see how Congress, with the work that they're continuing to do on trying to attach the infrastructure bill to a reconciliation bill, it means that they're cutting it kind of close. But again, we've got until October or November to see that get resolved.
It just feels to me, Kate, the sides feel a little bit more dug in. And look, every Treasury Secretary ever since we've had a debt limit has said to Congress, come on, just pay the bills, right? Democrat and Republican. But the two sides do seem a little more dug in this time.
I think there's definitely a little bit more unease over what's going to happen here. And definitely folks who pay attention to this, who've followed this over the past decade or so, since we've had kind of these bigger, more dramatic battles over this issue, they're saying, yes, it's different this time. Just a couple of years ago, I don't know if we remember, you probably don't, there was this this drama-free agreement between Steve Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi. Yes. Barely, people barely noticed it. They got it done. It was part of this broader budget agreement that Brian mentioned a minute ago. Now it's just hard to see how there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle, right? Because you have the reconciliation bill, you have an infrastructure bill, you have government spending. So on the one hand, there's a few different ways that they could do this, but you have Republicans saying, no way, we're not helping with this. So yeah, it's a little bit murkier for sure this time.
A little bit. Interesting way to run an economy. That's Kate Davidson of the Wall Street Journal. Brian Chung on a Friday afternoon. He's at Yahoo Finance. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Enjoy your weekend. On Wall Street today, it is five down days in a row. And you know what? That is okay. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just because the president says something is going to happen doesn't mean it's going to happen right away. You know, case in point, President Biden yesterday ordering OSHA, that's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to come up with emergency rules requiring vaccines or regular testing for employees of businesses with more than 100 people. That much you've surely heard. Marketplace Caroline Champlin explains how those rules make their way from the White House policy shop to the Federal Register.
Some people love rules and making them.
I am enthusiastic about rulemaking.
That's Linda Rosenstock, UCLA professor and former head of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which works with OSHA. And she says it's a big deal to have a directive straight from the White House. David Michaels teaches at George Washington University and was the longest-serving head of OSHA.
I don't recall a presidential order requiring a standard. I don't think that has happened before.
And he says the pressure is on. OSHA advisors first have to prove COVID-19 is a grave risk to workers. Michael says that's pretty clear. Next, is the standard effective and feasible for employers? Then come the lawyers to get the policy court ready, not David Michael's favorite part.
On one level, I hate it because it really slows down the process.
But winning legal battles is worth it.
And that does feel good because once it's out there and survived court cases, then you know it's there forever and it changes the world. And that's what's so rewarding.
Some states have their own OSHA. Debbie Berkowitz, a former OSHA senior official, says the government has an answer if they try to resist federal standards.
Okay, well, if you don't do it, we're going to come take over your state plan, because the law is you have to have as equal as protection as federal OSHA.
Or states can come up with more effective rules, something she encourages. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
Entergy, the power company in New Orleans, said today that power's been turned back on for about 80% of the almost 1 million customers who lost it in Hurricane Ida, which is great, but it also means, if you look at it another way, that the lights are still off in a good chunk of the homes in Louisiana. Co Bragg is a journalist. She is based in New Orleans, and she talked on this program last year about buying a house in New Orleans for our series Adventures in Housing.
I have a lovely, like, classic New Orleans front porch that I love to just, like, stand out on and, you know, wave at my neighbors.
So given everything that has happened in New Orleans the past couple of weeks, we got her on the phone. Co, it's good to have you back on.
Yeah, nice to be here.
First of all, how are you, and how is that house that you told us so much about?
Sure. So I'm doing okay. I'm happy to know that the power came back on earlier this week. I had been out for just about a week's time after Ida. So I had an opportunity to go back and see my house, a few days after the storm. You know, I wanted to go back and get some friends who didn't have cars out of the city because it was just way too hot. Mm-hmm. And there's a tree on my roof. Like, there's a tree that's,
On your roof or through your roof?
It's on the roof. I can't quite see, you know, until we get that tree off.
Yeah.
But you know, like, it could have been so much worse, and is for so many people, especially outside of New Orleans.
This is a house, we should remind people, that you bought sight unseen, right? You clicked through some pictures on the internet, but I imagine really quickly this house became kind of a part of you.
Yeah, I mean, especially a house purchased in the pandemic, and, you know, I work from home, and it was hard to leave. Honestly, it's hard to evacuate. It's hard to do that kind of, should I stay or should I go? Because you want to be there, you know, to catch leaks or to make sure your house is okay. So I know that that is a reason why so many people stay.
What's it like for you and your friends and your family and people who you evacuated with or met when you left? What's it like for all y'all to see the national attention shift to all the flooding in New York and that sort of East Coast focus that a lot of the coverage has had since almost the day after Ida hit New Orleans?
Sure. I think that the culture of being in Southeast Louisiana, a place where the coast has been eroding for years, in part due to the big fossil fuel industry, you know, thousands mm-hmm. of miles of Louisiana coast that's supposed to protect us from storm damage and all of that stuff is gone. And so there's a culture of preparedness and also of knowing that people are not coming to save us, and that there's a deep community care infrastructure that exists in this region that, frankly, the rest of the country has a lot to learn from.
Would you like to even hazard a guess as to how long it's going to be before your neighborhood is back to normal?
Yeah, I think that part is going to be hard, because I think when I went back to check on my house, I was just giving out water to people who have stayed, but also it's extremely expensive to evacuate. God. You know, I sent some money to a new mom who had, you know, left with her newborn, and she was like, I have to pay for hotels on my way back from Georgia, but I just don't have that kind of cash on hand. And so thinking about that, it's going to take a while for people to come back. And also, once you get back, that's when you really have the wherewithal to deal yeah. with, am I going to apply for FEMA aid? What does that even look like? How long is it going to take? Because if you look just over to the western corner of our state at Lake Charles, which got hit with Hurricane Laura last year, there's people still waiting in houses covered with blue tarp for that FEMA aid and other government aid to come in.
All right. So here's the $64,000 question. Would you buy that house again?
absolutely would buy that house again. And I have a friend who's born and raised in New Orleans. And the way she put, she's also a new homeowner. And the way she put it is that even if New Orleans one day is completely underwater, she'll be proud to own a little piece of land in the ocean. And I think that's how a lot of people feel. It's a very proud area. It's that care infrastructure that I can't stress enough that makes you want to stay. And it's also why we wanted to rush back to help people that are really in need and really love their neighbors.
Coe Bragg is a reporter, editor, journalist, also a homeowner in the city of New Orleans. Coe, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up,
people desensitize themselves to that.
It's the not knowing, really. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 271 today, 0.7%, 34,607. The NASDAQ off 132, 0.8%, 15,115. And the S&P 500 down 34, about 0.7%, 44,058. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 2.1%. NASDAQ down 1.6%, S&P 500 down 1.7%. Caroline Chaplin was telling about OSHA and rulemaking. So how did the vaccine stocks do today? Pfizer down 0.9%. Moderna sank 1.4%. Johnson & Johnson down 0.6%. The producer price index, as I mentioned, up 8.3% year over year, 0.7% in August. About a third of August gain came from health, beauty, and optical goods. Self-care, people. It's self-care. Ulta Beauty faded 1.9%. Today you're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We got a quite nice, thank you very much, snapshot of the labor market this week. First-time claims for unemployment fell down to about 310,000, the lowest they have been since the before times, which is great. And on Wednesday, the Beige Book, the Federal Reserve's eight times a year regional survey of this economy, said, quote, demand for workers continued to strengthen, but it also said, quote, all districts noted extensive labor shortages. So Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman walks us through all of the ends, ifs, or buts of this still pandemic-y labor market.
The continuing decline in unemployment claims means there have been fewer layoffs. But aside from that,
lately, there's not a lot going right in the job market. And of course, that's all due to the Delta variant.
Economist Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union says hiring has slowed in leisure and hospitality and retail, and more people are afraid of working now. Employers say they can't find workers to hire as the economy reopens, so silver lining.
Employers are having such a hard time keeping workers, they are really loath to let them go. So that provides job security, I think, for a lot of people.
Making matters worse for employers, people are quitting their jobs at high rates right now. Adam Santinello of Windsor, Connecticut, recently quit a call center job after 7 months. He says the money was good, but
I just didn't see the difference I was making anymore, and I'm at a point where I just want to do something that makes me happy.
Like the restaurant work he used to do. Meanwhile, he's applied for unemployment. That and relief payments have helped a lot of people hold out financially, says Jesse Wheeler at polling firm Morning Consult.
That cushion will provide you the ability to refrain from entering back into the labor force if you're concerned about health or if you need to take care of a loved one.
Employers are pulling out all the stops, says Jeremy Kyman at global staffing firm Adecco. Higher pay, bonuses, fast offers and counteroffers. But there are still a lot of potential workers on the sidelines. What'll it take to get them back?
A lot of these are people that have gotten used to working from home and or are still balancing childcare issues because there's a lack of childcare workers.
One thing many economists agree on, prolonged labor shortages will hurt businesses' ability to meet demand and grow. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
While stressful for all of us, of course, the past 18 months have been just a little bit extra painful for parents. The Zoom schooling thing, the working from home while the kids are Zoom schooling thing. And now, as most schools are back in person, another wrench in the works. Where the heck is the school bus that's supposed to pick up my kid? Marketplace's Matt Levin explains why there are fewer of those big yellow buses in that morning drop-off line.
Two nights before her daughter's first day of seventh grade, after more than a year of remote learning, Bailey Sands got an unexpected email from Belding Elementary School in Chicago.
Due to the bus driver shortage, your child might not be on the bus system.
Not a great situation, considering Sands has a job and a 10-month-old.
Almost comical if it wasn't so annoying.
So where did all the bus drivers go? First, would you want to be a school bus driver right now? Michael Cordiello leads a New York City school bus drivers union.
The biggest calls we get during school are, you know, I have a kid refusing to wear a mask. What do I do?
Cordiello says health concerns are pushing many of his members to retire. Other drivers are now making sure you get the school supplies you ordered on Amazon Prime. Lynette Washington at Baltimore City Public Schools estimates 30% of bus drivers have left since the pandemic hit.
It's now a challenge to get bus drivers to come back. Those industries are paying more, a lot more than what we pay.
So instead, the school district is paying parents $250 a month if they drive their kids to school, which Washington acknowledges isn't an option for every family.
Families that are special needs families, homeless families.
Still, she says about 300 families have signed up so far. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is the 11th of September, and of the millions of stories of that day and of the past 20 years, we've been trying to find our way to the economic through line since that Tuesday morning. We thought about doing this straight ahead, the costs of the attacks on New York and Washington and Shanksville, the economic damage done in those moments, the costs of the wars we've fought since 2001. And we thought about all the infrastructure we've built in the past two decades, the TSA, and the hardened buildings, and new inspections and regulations, financial and otherwise. And then I went back to listen to our stories from this week in 2011, and I found this.
Our generation asked, what were you doing when the Twin Towers fell? And the same way that a generation ago, we asked, what were you doing when Kennedy was shot? So to me, I think that impact is so much greater than any economic impact, you know, how it affects our soul.
That's economist Brock Blomberg on this program 10 years ago when he was at Claremont McKenna College.
And that's funny for an economist to use that word. But I think, to me, that's what I think of when I think September 11.
And this is him today.
There are much deeper, you know, impactful economic things than terrorism in terms of impacting the economy. And I think over time, people desensitize themselves to that. The uncertainty is still there.
Now, looking 20 years later,
economist Nick Bloom is at Stanford.
You realize 9/11 in some ways was the first ripple for a series of incredible uncertainty shocks.
He created something called the Economic Policy Uncertainty Index,
which were, of course, followed by the global financial crisis, followed by the pandemic, and followed by Trump. I mean, those three events show up on most measures as even bigger bursts of uncertainty than 9/11.
And it's not just that this uncertainty has been piling on us for 20 years.
So if you feel that, you know, things are probably more uncertain than they have been for a long time, you're probably feeling about right. I mean, that seems to be the case for America.
It's the kind of uncertainty Economists talk about uncertainty a couple of different ways.
One, you can think of almost as like risk. It's things that are uncertain, but you know the distribution. So imagine rolling a fair dice. Any one of the six numbers has a 1/6 chance, and you know, it's like going into a casino. It's uncertain what number the roulette wheel is going to come up to, but you know what all the possibilities were.
And that's kind of what it's been like covering this economy the past 20 years. I can make a pretty good guess most times about what this corporate move or that corporate move was going to be, what the Fed was going to do, how consumers were going to react. But underneath it was a different strain of not knowing.
9/11 felt very different in it's what economists have called night in uncertainty. It's something just you never conceived of. Certainly, I personally, when you talk to pretty much anyone, would never think of terrorists hijacking planes and flying them into multiple buildings.
And there's even, kind of ironically, I guess, a nod to Rumsfeld here, too.
Night in uncertainty, where things are just, you know, unknown unknowns, is much harder to deal with.
The story of September 11th in this economy isn't straight ahead. It's not just the absolute costs, the dollar amounts, or the extra time some things take. It's 20 years of the uncertainty that Nick Bloom and Brock Blomberg are talking about. 20 years and who knows how many more years of not knowing for businesses and for governments and for us. Okay, we're going. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend. And look, take a moment tomorrow, would you? We'll see. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.